Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's time once again for another OC Spotlight. The one show, the only show that shows you the most incredible people doing the most amazing things. And the events coming through town, like one you're going to kick out of hearing about in just a moment as we bring in somebody. We do a business channel mostly. We don't have a whole lot of musicians that come by here, but when we do, we get pretty excited about it, particularly when it's somebody I remember so well. Welcome, if you will, to the show, the artist, Gilbert O'Sullivan. Gilbert, welcome to the show.
I'm sure you remember, you must have been only a child when I was...
We're not that far apart. You know, I know you got a couple of years on me maybe, but I was in college radio in the 1970s. I went to college in the 1970s and started in radio and well-versed in pop music at the time. And there was a hit, or several hits that you had, but the one that sticks in my mind was Alone Again Naturally. I mean, go Google that one. Go look on that. If that doesn't instantly ring a bell for you, go look it up, and I guarantee you when you hear it, I played it for my wife, and she was like, oh, I love that song. So, you know, you definitely touched some lives, and it still resonates all these years later. So thank you for joining us here today. You're coming through town. Let's plug it up front, and then we'll plug it again. You're going to play at the famed Coach House here in San Juan Capistrano. Everybody knows the Coach House here. It's been around for a million years. And you're going to play on Monday, April 8th, not too far away here, a couple of weeks away here. What brings you to Orange County? You've never been here before, right?
We started touring again in the States about 5 years ago. Up to that point, I had a really big band, good band. We used to go on the road. But you couldn't get into America because the cost, the expense of bringing a band over is
huge.
I'll
bet, yeah.
Worse now. But then when we downsized to just myself and my guitar player, we found that was really became very popular because it's up close and personal. People like the intimacy of just having two people on stage.
Absolutely.
And so that led to us getting the break to come to America. So we came to New York, Washington, and a few other places. We've ended up now, this will be our third trip to come and visit you. And it's been fantastic to after all those years. It's funny when you walk out on stage and say, it's good to be here after 30 years.
I guess so. Well, the only other one that came through our studios, I want to say a few years ago, I don't recall exactly when, but it was several years ago, was Peter Asher of Peter and Gordon, another contemporary, maybe a couple of years prior to your hit record run there.
I sat on a plane with him once coming back from Los Angeles.
I think he lives out here somewhere, if I'm not mistaken. I think he lives somewhere, wherever he lives now.
And, you know, he managed James Taylor in those early days.
Yeah, so he propelled that and then ended up going for Apple Records and finding James Taylor and working with so many others like that. And it's just an amazing career. So I want to go through all this. We only got about 25 minutes here. Let's remind people the story of Gilbert O'Sullivan. You come from Ireland. How do you get to be on Top of the Pops several years later? That's quite an account. Because there aren't a lot of, you know, later we think of YouTube and some of these others, but I mean, but I don't think there's a lot of huge pop artists that come out of Ireland, are they? Even though you're right next to England?
No, in fact, there wasn't any before me in that early 70s. And so there was no U2 or Thin Lizzy around at that time.
Yeah, Thin Lizzy was the other one, right.
The interesting thing about me is that unlike most Irish artists, like a U2, Thin Lizzy, or The Corrs, or people like that, they established themselves in Ireland before they became international successes. With me, it didn't work that way with me. We moved to England when I was 7 years old, grew up in Swindon, went to college in Swindon. All my musical background comes from living in Swindon. So my history in terms of music is all about starting in England as opposed to starting in Ireland.
Right. And was that dramatically different? I don't know what the music scene was in Ireland. Were they just playing American songs and British songs, or was there distinctive Irish style? I know you weren't emulating that because you're in England, but I don't know what was going on in Ireland in the late 60s.
I think in those days, Paul, it was the Clancy brothers and the Chieftains, and that day
I love the Clancy brothers and the Chieftains, by the way. I'm very Irish here.
I mean, that was the Irish music scene and stuff.
Yeah, playing traditional, traditional Irish music. All right, so you're in England, and how the heck did you become a hit maker? I mean, that's a huge, that's a one in a million shot in and of itself. I was looking at your Wikipedia story here. quite involved. You ran into some other famous people along the way on your way up and other bands and stuff. Take us a quick journey through how this kid, in this Irish kid in England, goes on to create a couple of big pop songs, pick hits, and get on top of the pops.
Well, I mean, I started to write songs because of the Beatles, and we all wanted to be in a band. Mm-hmm. So I was in a really good band, ended up in a really good band called Rick's Blues. And that was Rick Davies, who went on to form Supertramp.
Yeah,
so
right.
We were a really good band, and we could have actually turned professional. This would be about 1966. But the guitar player and the bass player were on apprenticeship, so they didn't want to risk giving up their job. So Rick and I had to decide what to do. I was determined to have a go at being a solo singer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was the drummer in Rick's Blues. And then Rick needed to be in a band. He couldn't be on his own. So he joined a band called The Lonely Ones, a band called The Joint, which became Supertramp. Then I went to London, 67, to break into the business. And that led to me getting recording contracts, publishing contracts. People liked my songs. I was into getting really good with songwriting and stuff. And that was the key to everything I did in terms of success. How I looked was very different.
Now, when I looked it up in Wikipedia, it's somewhere along the way you went from being a drummer to being a piano player. And they noted in there, and when I watched the video, I noticed it. You don't play like a typical piano player. It's almost like a left-hand, right-hand kind of drum kind of action here. Is that true?
Yeah, it's very rhythmic. I mean, when I write rock and roll songs, I mean, it's good that I can create the drum sound with my left hand. I'm not pianoforte. I can't do all that stuff.
Right.
But I can chord. I can hit the chord. So I'm a good rhythm player.
Mm-hmm.
So the right hand will play the rhythm chord. The left hand will play the drums. And I can rock it up as good as anybody.
All right. So here you are, another wannabe rocker in the English scene. To me, this is the heyday of rock and roll. Late 60s into the 70s. That's when so many Supertramp, 1,000 other bands we could rattle off here in America and England, that followed the success of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, some of these, and now there's this next wave taking it to the next level. What was that world like? And take us through that, to be in London in that scene and to be part of it and to be an up-and-coming artist and eventually a successful artist.
Well, I mean, after having spent 4 years at art schools, coming to London to break into the business, I needed a job. So I got a job as a temporary postal clerk in Mobile African Services. And so that gave me the £10 a week, which allowed me to be able to buy a piano in my flat. You could buy a piano in those days for about £10.
Wow.
So wages would get me a piano. And you're talking 67 fashion with King's Road, with music, the Stones, the Beatles. I mean, it was a magical time. So to be involved in that, I mean, I was working with good producers. I was writing good songs. People were very interested in what I was doing, but they didn't like how I looked.
That was the other thing. I'd forgotten all of that thing around how you looked. You decided, if Wikipedia is correct here, you had this kind of, what should we call it? Kind of this Irish plowman, or I don't know, it was a cap, and or it was Charlie Chapman, or something. It was not a Vogue look. It was not a current look.
No, the catalyst for me with an image was that when the Beatles came out, they wrote great songs. We identified with them because they couldn't read music yet. They could write great songs.
Yeah.
Felt that they could do it. But they looked different. They had the Beatle haircut.
They sure did.
Their forward, collarless jackets. So the image was the key factor for me. I knew I was writing good songs, but I didn't want to look ordinary. I didn't want to look like James, bless him. I didn't want to grow my hair long and look pretty much everybody. I wanted to be different. And I loved Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. I used to go to the seasons at the Academy Cinema to watch them and stuff. So I used to hire a Chaplin jacket, a bobtail jacket from the theatrical costumers.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I borrowed it, they would say, "What's the production for?" I'd say, "It's only for me to look in the mirror at the weekend."
Yeah.
And so, so the Chaplin jacket, the cap and boots, I cut my hair very short.
Yeah, right.
Which is now the height of fashion. But in those days, as you already know, long hair was here to stay.
Absolutely.
So nobody, none of the record companies liked how I looked. But I was so determined to use it. And because they liked the songs, they agreed to sign me. So that's pretty much what happened between 67 and 69. And that's when I met Gordon Mills, who managed Tom Jones in England.
Famous producer. Yeah. Gordon Mills managed Tom Jones and Engelbert Humperdinck, didn't he?
Yeah, both people. In fact, Engelbert will be maybe coming to see us when we're in
I'd love to meet him and or start to see him and say hi. And I think he also managed, who else did he manage? Somebody, I think he managed Eric Clapton?
No. He managed Gilbert O'Sullivan, just the three. I mean, everybody thinks that he called me Gilbert O'Sullivan. I called myself Gilbert when I came to London. I saw myself as a singer called Gilbert and as a writer called O'Sullivan. And I kind of like the idea that if you bought the 45, you'd see that the artist was Gilbert, and underneath you'd see written by somebody called O'Sullivan.
Right.
So I like the fact that it was different.
Is it play on words like Gilbert and Sullivan, obviously? Yeah.
But Gordon Mills was a great manager, so I knew that he didn't like the image, but he knew that the songs were good because he co-wrote It's Not Unusual. He co-wrote a lot of songs.
I didn't know that, yeah. Well, I knew he drove those careers to super height. How did you even get to meet him? Just do you submit music and then does somebody introduce you? Does he come and hear you at a club? How do you meet somebody like that?
No, I just sent it. I had a little tape. I sent it to... The first tape I ever sent was from my home in Swindon. I sent it to Page One Record, Larry Page, who managed the Troggs.
Yeah, Wild Thing.
So I sent the tape, but it would be an hour by train from Swindon to London. After a few weeks, I got no response. So I went up to London, and I stormed into their office, and I said, I want my tape back.
You're not going to do anything with it. Give it back to me. Yeah.
The girl said, you know, we get hundreds of tapes sent to her. They said, well, I've come all the way from Swindon, and I'm desperate to have this tape back. It's the only one I've got. So I persevered, and they found my tape, which hadn't been opened. So that's the tape that I ended up sending to Gordon Mills. And so what happened was that I received a telephone call in my flat to say there was a Mr. Jones wanting to talk to me, who was Gordon Mills' assistant.
Mm-hmm.
That led to me going to his home, and he heard the songs on the tape, which he liked, but he wanted to be sure that I could write more. Mm-hmm. So I played him a few more songs that I'd written. So that pleased him enough to want to sign me and stuff. And the interesting thing there is when I left his home, I was driven back to the station, so it would have been quite late at night. I'd get the train back to London, which would take about 45 minutes. I missed the last train, so I actually fell asleep, went to bed on the platform. But I was in a kind of high. I was on a kind of high after getting Mills to...
I can imagine. I've heard stories before. The only I'll give you another quick one. We had Gino Vannelli a couple of years around that same time, probably mid-70s, late 70s. And he came through town, and we did an interview with him. And he told the story. He'd had a minor hit record as a teenager in Canada, came to the United States, came to California, came to L.A., tried everything he could. Nobody would listen, sent the tapes. Nobody. He's literally down to his last dollar. He's going back home with his tail tucked between his legs, and he decides to go down to A&M Records and charge the gate. He's going to run in and try and see if he can see Herb Albert when he comes out. He's going to stick the before they yank him out, he's going to say, listen to this, and he did it. And the guard kept saying, don't you try it. Don't you try it. I know what you're thinking. Don't you come through. I'm going to do it. And when he saw Herb get in his car, he ran, got the tape to him. And the next day, Herb called him. And a week later, he's recording next to the Carpenters. You know,
Yeah, that's brilliant. And that's the key factor there is that self-belief.
Yes.
You may not be as good as you think you are, but thinking you are is good.
Yes. That kind of chutzpah to go in there and just do this and not say no. There's hundreds of tapes. There's millions of tapes over there. Why would they find your tape? Why would they listen to your tape? But they did. You got them to it.
And the other thing was that when I went to Gordon Mills, one of the questions he's always going to ask, they always ask, are you signed to anybody else?
Mm.
Your song signed to anybody else and stuff. So what I did before I met Gordon, I was represented by a couple of people. One in particular I'd signed a contract with. So I went to his home late at night. His mother opened the door and I said, look, I've been trying to get out of this contract. Nothing has really happened with him. Can you let me go? Can you get your son to sign me off? And she called her son out and said, give this boy back his contract.
Give him back. Don't hold on to him. Don't hold him back here.
So then Gordon Mills knew. So when I went to Gordon Mills, I was clear of having to, because if I was signed with other people, he might well have backed off and stuff. So
what does your family think? What do your friends think? For them, this must have been just an impossible dream. Come on. Eventually, you're going to come to your senses. This isn't going to happen. It's a one in a million shot. And you made it happen. It's a one in a million shot. And within a very short period of time, I don't know how many records it took to get to that hit Alone Again Naturally, but it seems like it was pretty quick.
Yeah. I mean, the first success was a song called Nothing Rhymed, which was a huge hit all around Europe. Australia, New Zealand.
I don't think it played here as much. I don't remember that.
No. But a big hit in England and stuff. So that opened the door for me. That was a huge success. And the interesting thing with that song was that when Gordon Mills signed me, that wasn't one of the new songs that I'd written that he heard. So that actually came later. So, but that opened the door. And then next record was very different. That was okay. The third record, when we did Alone Again, the interesting thing with Alone Again was that, Gordon Mills allowed me to give up my job, so I was able to write full time. Mm-hmm. And £10 a week I was earning as a clerk. He gave me £10 a week with it.
So you're writing for his music publishing company or whatever. I'm trying to see if you.
In a kind of way like that, Paul. But anyway, the writing of those songs, I was writing a song called Out of the Question and a song called Alone Again. Both I'm very happy with the songs. No idea what's going to happen to them, which is how it should be. You never want to know if success, because that's dangerous. Mm. If you know what every song you're going to write, you're going to have that same feeling.
Yeah.
The key is when you write with it, you think it's a good song, that's it. So we recorded. In those days, you made a single. You went in the studio for 3 hours. You did an A side and a B side.
Right.
So the songs we went in were Alone Again and Out of the Question. Everybody said Out of the Question is the most commercial.
That's the A side. The other's the B side. Maybe the DJs like me will find it and flip it over and play it here. Yeah.
But anyway, but Gordon Mills decided by the end of the evening that even though Alone Again isn't the most commercial, we think it's a better song, so let's go with it. So the rest is history. It's become for you more important. It's a more important song for America than it is for
It was huge. Now, I got to ask you, because the minute you reminded me of this song, which I hadn't heard in a while, but I instantly remembered, go look it up, Alone Again Naturally, everybody hearing my voice will instantly remember that song, particularly if you're around my age. And a couple of questions I got to ask you about as I was listening to it. I thought, what are we going to talk about? Let's talk about that song. That song is not a typical pop song. It's depressing, first of all. Maybe depressing is the wrong word, but it's a sad story. We all have some to be hoppy, cheery, I want to hold your hand, you know, it's upbeat. Songs are not supposed to be real or dark or any tone of sad. That's a very sad song. As I recall the song, my wife said it instantly. She said, I remember the song. First thing, he wants to go up and throw himself off a tower because he's been stood up at the altar. And then later on, it goes on and talks about the death of his father. Okay. And you cried and cried all day. That line has stuck with me. When my father died a few years ago, I cried and cried all day. And then the haunting line about my mother, God rest her soul, something like trying to remember why the only man she ever loved's been taken. Yikes. This is real, raw stuff. This isn't what I picture late 60s, early 70s pop music to sound like or talk about.
But that's the joy of songwriting, Paul. That's the reason I love songwriting, because it's a gift. Where you're able to sit there in a room on your own with a piano and a notebook, and you're able to come up with songs. That, for example, Neil Diamond gave a big interview because he's recorded Alone Again, and he sent me a letter hoping that I liked it. But he was giving an interview, he said he loved that song, but he couldn't understand how somebody so young could have written.
That was my next question. Was this based on a real thing, or were you just fantasizing, thinking this through in your head here?
I think that you don't have to experience a subject. Be able to write about it. Mm-hmm. It's an understanding. You go into the personality of the person. That's the fascination with songwriting, because you get into a subject. You don't have to experience it. I mean, people will always say it must be based on personal experience.
That was my first question. But didn't Gordon look at this and say, oh my God, this is too dark. This is not what kids are going to buy or people are going to buy. It's real. I think it's sung in a way. It's not maudlin. It's not playing to emotion, but it's a real, a guy's just had some real run of bad luck here, and here I am alone again, naturally. And I think so many of us think, oh my God, that's real. That's what people like today on YouTube. This is being played on YouTube. They want real, authentic, genuine. Don't give me the fake, saccharine, phony stuff. Even if it's not all happy and perfect, tell me real. I think that song stands alone in that era of songs as being one of the few that was very real.
And you know, interesting, the cover versions I get of it, Paul, like Diane Krall and Michael Bublé recorded it. Actually, she did a naughty thing by changing the lyrics without getting permission. But I loved Nina Simone. I loved her.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Goddamn is one of my favorite tracks that she ever did. So the cover versions are really, it's a compliment to you as a songwriter. It doesn't matter who likes it, but the fact that it's been recorded by such well-known people going right back, Andy Williams, Sarah Vaughan, wonderful versions of this. So that's the joy of...
Go remember all these names. For anybody my daughter's age who's going to say, who's Andy Williams and Nina Simone and Sarah Vaughan? Oh, my God. I'm embarrassed to say, go look.
She'll know Bublé. She'll know Bublé.
Yeah, she'll know Michael Bublé. All right, so she's all of 30 and thinks that the Beatles were Paul McCartney was a guy who did a Band on the Run. They didn't know he had a little band before that. I have to ask one more time: was there any pushback to this kind of material, or was it so unique and so different that that's what the appeal was? Did they say no? Write something happy. Write something upbeat.
But I have no input in how I write. It's got nobody's business but mine.
Right.
Nobody, never would co-write or never work with people who I'd say, have a listen to this. I just wrote on my own. If I was happy with it, that was success because that's what I had control of. Once it's out on the marketplace, everybody's failed with what they thought would be a success. Everybody's had those
ideas. And so many people try and write what they think will be a hit. I think that's the problem with music today. It's like a machine. They write the beat. They're testing everything. They're trying everything. It isn't necessary. I'm not saying all of it. Taylor Swift is certainly known for writing very personal kind of music. But so much of it feels like a factory. Even in the 60s, certainly, there was a lot of factories. The hit factories and everything. We did the Newport Beach Film Festival here, and we had Tommy Tedesco's son, who did a documentary about the Wrecking Crew, the famous group of musicians who played on everything from Sinatra to the Beach Boys. And people didn't know that it was the same basic unit that was playing all these songs, and that gave it a certain pop feel to it. It was a production. But this is not fit that production. So I think that's what struck out. That's why I remember the song so well. I think that's why it was a hit. And, congratulations that you wrote it and people allowed you to do it. I would have thought they would try and to put that one away. We'll do that one later here. All right.
Yeah, I mean,
so you got that. Now you're on, literally, I saw it. You're on Top of the Pops. That's pretty impressive. Because if it's a hit song, you get to be on Top of the Pops and other places around the world. Did you start traveling? Did you start touring? What happens next when you have a big hit record?
Well, normally what happens is you get your start in the clubs. You work in clubs and you build your way up to supporting a major act, and then you become a big act yourself. I didn't have that background. I had a background of writing songs, but no background of working. So I was new to performing. Mm. So my first success with Nothing Rhymed, by the time Alonian came out, that was the first time I was actually touring. So I actually didn't tour with the first success, which is unusual. So it's taken me years really to be a good performer because I was quite naive in those days. So I didn't tour much. The interesting thing with America was that my tour of America on the strength of 3 million sellers, because Alone Again sold a couple of million.
Yeah.
Claire was a million seller.
Claire was the other song. Go look that one up. That was another. I remember that one. I don't remember that one as well, I have to say. I remembered it when I played it, but Alone Again struck me the minute I heard it, I guess because it was so different. Yeah.
Yeah. With that amount of success, my manager with Humperdinck and Tom Jones going to big venues, had to decide two things to decide for me was, do I go and support the Moody Blues and build my career that way?
Right.
Do I go out like Tom and Engelbert on a big arena?
Right.
And that was a huge mistake that was made on my behalf. I mean, I'm writing the songs. I'm not in charge of performing.
Sure.
So the tour was a wonderful disaster.
A wonderful disaster. So big venues, and you're like, this isn't me. This isn't, I'm writing intimate kind of songs here. Yeah.
Not private playing with orchestra and stuff. We had a great time and stuff. But the tour got pulled before we got to California. We got to the West Coast.
And was there ever a temptation to do what Gordon Mills did with Tom Jones and Engelbert's, put you into Vegas and places like that and do the...
No, I was never going to be that kind of an artist. I think the singer-songwriter thing came through with James. Mm-hmm. And then you had, other people in the early 70s.
James Taylor just changed everything because suddenly... Up until that time, I was afraid to ask you if you'd even written the song, because up until that time, there was an A&R person who brought you material, artist and repertoire, matched the artist and the repertoire. And so many bands of the 60s didn't write any of the songs. Performed to the people.
I loved Carole King and Goffin and King. And so I loved all the Brill Building songwriting. That was my fact. That's how I kind of operate today in terms of writing. I have the Brill Building mentality, clocking in at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Into a piano.
It's a job.
Sit there at 5 o'clock. see what you can come up with. Clock off. Don Kirshner owned the building where the Brill Building
is. That's right. That's right. He did. And so, that's, you know, how he got the Monkees and all these other things. And then he would just go get Neil Diamond to write a hit for the Monkees. And the Monkees didn't even write anything. And then later on they did, and, you know, to try and prove themselves. But yeah, that's the way it was. I go look that up too. I don't think people remember that era, the Brill Building and the Wrecking Crew, the same guys that played on all the records and all this stuff here.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
phenomenal. All right, so this hits, big wave, like everything, tastes change, times go on. Did you stay in the business? Did you keep writing? It seems, I was surprised to see that you were on your 19th record or something. You've obviously stayed performing and stayed writing throughout this time. I would have thought, you know, maybe there was some time away, or maybe you tried something else. I was in the music business side of it, like Peter Asher did. I was into management. I was into engineering. I was into just something else. Did you dabble with any of that, or are you just stuck with it and you continued to perform and record for these many years?
No, I mean, we're talking sort of mid-70s. Things were quietening down.
Right.
So I said to Gordon, my manager, who also produced my records, Gordon produced, good producer, as well as managing me. Mm-hmm. I said to Gordon, let me work with other producers. Let me work, for example, Rod Stewart did Atlantic Crossing with a big-time American producer. I forget the name now. But these were the people that were becoming more as popular artists.
The taste changed. So then who's the hot producers now? And let's get them in. They got the sound.
And Phil Ramone was another one who I really liked and stuff. So anyway, so I said to Gordon, let me work with other producers. You're still my manager. He couldn't agree with that. He did not agree with that. So I had to make a decision. Do I stay with Gordon and things are just nice the way they are?
Right.
I'm a wealthy boy and all that stuff. Or do I, you know, the ambition is still in me, and that drive is still there. So we parted company, and that led to huge legal problems, huge.
I'll bet we hear that all the time, and that ties you up, and nobody will touch you for a while.
Big court case, Paul, but it ended up successfully for me. Then by the time mid-80s, early 90s, I was still writing at home, of course. But the first record I brought out after all that came out in 1990. We had a song called So What, which was kind of minor hit. So things were starting to move again, and it was from there that I got back into the live performance. So throughout the 90s, I was getting much better, leading to today where, I wouldn't be touring, Paul, if it wasn't for the writing. It's the writing that keeps me going, because the love of songwriting is still there. To sit at the piano and come up with a tune, original tune, and then to sit down with a lyric, have no idea where it's going to go, what it's going to be about. It's a fascinating process.
And what's the process for you? Does one come before the other? Do you tinker around until you hear some little riff and you say, that's interesting, let's develop that? Or does it start with an idea and a lyric and I want to create music for this?
Well, you don't think about it, you just do it. But I mean, 9 times out of 10, it's a melody that will dictate the kind of lyric you'll write. You can determine if it's a kind of sad melody. You can determine if it's sweet. You can determine if it's rocky, if it's fun, humorous, or whatever. But it's all about on the piano. So there's never a shortage of ideas. Because the great thing, interesting thing with piano with me is chord-wise, I would sit with an arranger who would then want to get the chords to write the music for
me.
So I'd say to him, this chord is for this part. And he'd look at my fingers. He'd go, oh, that's just that. I said, no, it isn't just that. It has to be like that.
Right.
He said, no, that's it. So it's
A minor. Okay, well, we just put that down. We got that or something here.
So, you know, so that's the lack of knowledge about music actually helps you, because you're finding things out for the first time. First time you discover a minor chord, first time you discover a seventh,
yes, yeah, right.
They are, but they sound different to other chords.
Yeah, ooh.
That's part of fascination.
I saw an interview with Paul McCartney years ago, and he talked about they only knew like literally three or four chords when they started, and then people started introducing the more, you know, the more elaborate chords, a minor seventh, you know, and wow. You know, and then they have to run down and show each other, look at this, did you know you could do this? I think it's amazing that you guys all write music without having studied this. I dreamed it, as you can tell maybe a little bit, had some of the same dream. I never got near anything that you ever did. Had some little local bands, played music and stuff, and tried to study some of this stuff here. And it's a real art to writing a pop song, how a song should progress and how it gets home again. You know, you go off and it soars and then it's got to come back to where it started. It's got to come home. And that, how do you make that journey, you know? I don't want to get too philosophical here, but it's Ulysses going off to find the world. Then he has to find his way home again. The Greek invented this a million years ago. It's always trying to return home, always trying to get home again. and figuring out creative ways to not just to catch your ear, but to make that journey, to make the bridge and then to get back again. It's quite an art. It really is. And so you people just say, I just sit and tinker around it, like in the Brill Building, and they just keep plunking away. Oh, that's cool. Do more of that.
Yeah. It's all of those things. I mean, it's a fascinating process. And the great thing is that technology is wonderful. The technology we have, I have a purpose-built recording studio. And, you know, if your guitar player makes a mistake and he's no longer around, you can just put in the mistake.
Yeah.
You can
twink. All right.
You want to detune everything and take it down. If you want to slow things up or speed them up, you can do it now without it affecting the vocal. So technology is wonderful. But to write songs, Paul.
The singer's a little flat. Let's just make it. Yeah, we'll just.
Auto-tuning.
Yeah.
Tuning is everywhere. It's horrible. But but it's the, you know, the technology for me is I do all my writing on cassettes. Cassettes for me. And
literally an old fashioned like cassette, you just turn it on and you're just this.
I started off reel to reel and then I bought a tape recorder. So then I moved from a tape recorder to the cassettes. I tried all the digital devices which I bought. They're wonderful. Everything sounds brilliant on them, but they're annoying because you'd have to take your glasses off to pick up the damn thing to change and all that.
Yeah.
So with the cassette player, I stick the cassette player up, which is a 70s cassette player with the built in microphones either side.
Yeah.
Stick in the cassette, and if I got an idea, off we go. So that's it. So
and you I'm carry it with you all the time, and so wherever I am, you're walking down the street, you're eating at restaurants, you're, I don't know, doing your laundry, and all of a sudden, oh, something hits me, and I got to write this down and record this or something here.
I don't do that. For me, I'll sit at 9 o'clock and I'll see what happens. The good thing is that if you spend the day and nothing comes, you haven't wasted your time because you practiced. So
that's
from
true.
Being a lousy pianist, maybe I'm getting better.
There you are. All right. Well, we're going to find out because you're coming to Orange County for the very first time. All your world travels, all your success, all your hits. Sorry you never made it here before, but this ain't L.A. This is the new frontier. This is Orange County, whatever we are, somewhere be this the sixth biggest county in America, somewhere between Los Angeles and San Diego sits us, whatever we are. We're not L.A., we're not San Diego, we're something. This happens to be at the University of California, Irvine's Applied Innovation Center. High tech, med tech, medicines, all the stuff being developed around us. We're mostly a business show, and that's mostly what we report on. But when I saw your name, and I said, I just can't pass up this opportunity to have a chat with you and to spread the word, because I hope people will remember. I hope people will turn. I suspect they will, because the Coach House is real good at doing this.
Really looking forward to it.
I think it'd be fun. So again, it's Monday, coming up real soon here. This is Monday, April 8th at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano. You can go online and get tickets through that. What are we going to see? Is it a big band? Is it a big production or just you and a piano?
It's up close and personal, just myself and my guitar player. 2 hours of songs all written by myself. It's a good variety of stuff. So it's interesting. The up close and personal is really nice because people like the lyrics.
Yeah.
So with the band, you get criticism because people say, we love the band, but we couldn't really hear what you were saying.
Oh, yeah.
So what people like about this personal, this up close and personal, is that they get to hear the words. And that's kind of nice because it's interesting. Every lyric isn't just, I love you, baby, you love me. It has to be more than that.
I'm going to ask you to bash and trash modern music. And of course you won't, because you're going to say you love every much as it is. But today, so much of it is not a story that I grew up with. The song had a story. It touched you with a story. Too much of it today is just a beat or I love you, babe, or yeah, good, whatever. It doesn't seem real complex. I know they assemble songs literally with teams all over the place. Somebody writes this riff and they put this on it. And then somebody goes, yeah, baby. And it's just this assembled thing. And there you are.
I think, interesting thing today is if you look at Taylor Swift or even other well-known singers, particularly women, the writing credits are about 5-6 people.
Yes, right.
I do not understand that.
I don't either. It wasn't in the era we're talking about, a collaborative meeting. It's not like making a movie where there's 27 people write the script and then what you see is way different than what they started with here. It was a singer-songwriter. It was their, like it or not, this is my vision. This is what I'm hearing you say. Now, a producer would adapt that, the film Ramones of the world would add layers to it or something and maybe change it, but it was still your vision. Today, it's a corporate vision. It's and I guess maybe that's just a different role. I'm an old cranky old guy here now. It's collaborative. But some people like Taylor Swift still do tell personal stories. So much of the music I hear on the radio today ain't much of a story. Not for me.
There's stuff out there, Paul, but I go right back to the beginning of the 20th century. Stephen Foster is an influence for me because, you know,
Stephen
was the first singer-songwriter, the first contemporary songwriter. He was the one that influenced Irving Berlin because everybody thinks, who the hell influenced Berlin?
I never thought of that. Okay.
Foster.
The famous songs. Go back and look at his catalog. All these songs that were just the first tunes Americans all knew and hummed were Stephen Foster songs. I don't think there was anybody before him that everybody could sing and knew the songs. I'd have to go back and look them all up, but I know there's a million.
Susanna, Dream of Jeannie. So he was first, if you like, contemporary songwriter for the 20th century. But it's the Bacharach and Davids, Goffin and King, the Darker Greenfield, great writing. I mean, they were a big influence for all of us.
Yeah.
So, but there's still stuff out there. You can still, you know, it's within. I kind of like what's going on because from a production point of view, it interests me. A Jay-Z record, I won't like necessarily the song much, but I will love production, what's going on.
Yes. That's true. Last question here. Comment a little bit about the state of the music business today. From when I was a wannabe rock and roller and a DJ, it's changed. Radio is how you broke a record. Now radio is not how you break a record. In those days, it was about the records where you made all the money, the touring you almost did to give away just to get people to buy the record. Now it seems to be the opposite. They give away the music on Spotify, you get a penny or something, and the money is in touring. Taylor Swift is going to make $1 billion or whatever, $1 billion, just like Beyonce, off of the tour. The tour, the performance is everything. That seems to be, and the way you break music or find music, because there is no one place, it's all over the internet, it's all over SoundCloud, it's all over 1,000 mediums here. How do you even break through the noise and get found?
Well, you know, I don't find the opportunities are not still there because the last album, My Brother, was a success for me. In fact, the last two albums, including the current one, are the first successes I've had in top 20 England since about 30 years.
Wow.
So it's a good thing. But people are not buying CDs the way they used to. And that's why the bands are going on the road much more than they used to, because as you say, that's where they make their money. And stuff.
Yeah,
but for me, making records is still, you know, there's still opportunities out there. I like the business. I think for me, to be critical of it wouldn't really help me. I don't think.
It's just different. I don't know if it's harder or easier.
I love radio, so radio is very important for me.
Well, I love radio, but radio is almost dead. I mean, radio's dried up. And now new mediums like this, we're an online radio station. We're a podcast, basically, live podcasting. That's where the growth is. That's the new exciting mediums. And the stuff that gets heard on YouTube and live streamed and all this. That's the growth. It's not going in your car and listening to the five songs that the five buttons on your radio anymore here.
Well, I listen to English radio is very good, Paul, because you have Radio 2, which plays kind of middle of the road kind of stuff.
Right.
Radio 1 where it plays the more rockier stuff. It's a good, they're good stations. Six Music has a kind of indies type of stuff. Mm. So it's a bit like, you probably remember in the early 70s, radio stations, like my wife used to send me tapes because she was an air hostess. She lived in Los Angeles. So she would send me some of the radio stations, they're great music. I mean, there was.
Well, the great stations have died off. The great DJs, the great
KHJ. Remember KHJ?
KHJ, Big Boss Radio. Yeah, right. KHJ. We had Gary. I used to knew somewhat Gary Owens from KHJ, who was on Laugh-In and everything here. I got to meet him. He was kind of like a mentor, somebody that radio voice that I still try to emulate. That people laugh when I do now here. WMYK K94. Anyway, well, thank you so much for coming. I'm going to get a kick. Kind enough to give us a pair of tickets for the station, and we're going to give out some tickets. Not today, not on this thing. When it gets posted on LinkedIn, look for it. So if you're listening live, wait. It'll be out in a few days. We'll clean it up a bit and post it on LinkedIn. It's on YouTube right now, and we'll give away a pair of tickets. Don't miss the chance to go see Gilbert O'Sullivan. And not just relive those days, but catch up with him in an intimate setting and hear what he's up to these days and what's on his mind these days here? It's a rare opportunity because I asked you the off air. I guess I'll end with this. Why are you still doing it? You got a few years on me. I won't say your age, but I'm in my late 60s. You got a couple years on me. This is the time when we're supposed to quit and quiet and shut up and slow down. I'm not.
I'm 77 Sunset Strip, so I'm good.
Wow. I remember that show, too. Ed Cookie Burns. All right. Yeah. Well, I applaud you for going. I think that's what keeps you young, and don't ever stop. And I look forward to seeing you here and welcoming you to Orange County. Again, it's Monday, April 8th, coming up real soon at the Coach House here in San Juan Capistrano. You can call them, go online for tickets, or wait for our post on LinkedIn. Make sure you follow OC Talk Radio on LinkedIn, and we will put this out. We've gone way over our allotted time here, but what a rare chance, what a fun chance to talk to somebody who brings back all those memories for me, the music you did, the era that we both went through, and that time of our lives that I think is still very special. And in many ways, it's been, I don't know, it's just, I guess I'm an old guy. It's just not what it used to be. It's in some ways, I guess it's better, but I just miss those days of that, those scenes and the radio and that whole world of music seemed so important to all of us.
It's different today, but that's it.
That's it. And the fact is that you can still come and perform and do all these things. Where do you go? Are you going to tour the whole United States, or are you going to go the world, or you just go sporadically here and there? Where do you go with this?
I'm just finishing off a live album, 12 songs we call Songbook, and that will come out in September. Then I'm currently writing for songs that will be on a new album, which will start 2025. So that will come out next year.
And where do they go? I'd be remiss. I forgot to say, where do they go hear your music? I'm assuming you have a website and people can not only catch up with the tour and catch up with your life, but can catch up with the latest music here. Where do they go?
It's all on there. I have no idea. I'm totally...
Ask your daughter. You work with your daughter? Is that what she helps?
I don't know. She runs social media for me. I mean, she gets me to do things that I don't, you know, she drags me by the collar and says, you got to do
this. The one that was getting you on here, and she's like, oh, I'm going to get him up here and we're going to get going in a minute here. And I'm like, what is 9 or 10 o'clock in the Isle of Jersey here where you live in the Channel Islands here?
We'll pass that information on to I'll get her to pass that on. She does all the social media.
All right. She's up. She's listening now. I know she's in the room. Have her send me what's the website so people can tune in and stay current with Gilbert O'Sullivan, who's not alone naturally. He's going to be with a bunch of people here in Southern California coming up very soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Well, there you have it. We went a little bit long, but I think it was worth it. What will really be worth it is come by the Coach House on Monday, April 8th, and you can meet Gilbert O'Sullivan, relive those hits, and hear a whole bunch more. Only on Orange County's only community radio station.